This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Bob Pianta is with the Curry School of Education, and he joins us in studio to discuss a recent study conducted by his team at the Curry School that has... Is shaking the foundations of elementary schools everywhere. Bob, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Coy.
Thanks for joining me. The Daily Progress covered this story under the title UVA Study Slams Schools. Are you slamming schools here?
I don't think we're slamming schools. We're certainly describing what goes on in classrooms, and we're spending a lot of time in a lot of classrooms all across the country. I think what we're seeing... is not surprising to an awful lot of people. So that that headline was a little disconcerting, but I don't think we're slamming schools. In many ways, what we're trying to do is figure out the kind of supports that teachers are probably likely to need in order to feel and be more effective with kids.
This study, of course, was recently published in Science. It tracked 1,000 students in more than 25 states from age 3 to their current age of 17, and we were talking during the break, this is the largest study of its kind ever.
It's really the largest long-running comprehensive study of child development that's been conducted, and certainly the largest one in terms of studies that have observed children's experiences in classrooms.
So just by doing the very study, you've made history, and the results, let's discuss some of the results. They're really fascinating here. I mean, it really is. And every single parent and grandparent and school teacher needs to listen right now, folks. So just pay attention. The biggest study of its kind in the history of studying education in America, conducted right here at the University of Virginia. Well, I should say by a team here, but conducted around the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us first, before we talk about some of the results of the study, the nuts and bolts. How do you track 1,000 kids from age 3 to 17, I would imagine a few of them move.
a lot of them move. Actually, to be completely forthcoming, the study actually started when the children were born. So we enrolled the children at the time that their moms and dads arrived in the hospital and gave birth. And we are at UVA one of 10 sites across the country. Now, the key to any study of this sort are the relationships that you build with the parents and the families and the kind of commitment that they have to seeing this work get done. And I can tell you that over the course of 17 years working with these families, it's been extraordinary to see the level of support that they have for this, the understanding that they have of the value of this study, and the commitment of the staff to staying in touch with them.
Well, that's got to make it a whole lot easier for the professionals to get the data.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then I should say that the schools that we've been involved with, and this was an extraordinarily tough logistical challenge that we had in terms of contacting all these schools and getting permission to visit and everything. Again, terrifically supportive and collegial in the way that they worked with us.
So we're talking about many, many thousands of hours of an educational PhD professional literally sitting in a classroom watching somewhere in America, sitting in a classroom watching the teacher interact with the students.
You got it. Just think of spending a typical day in a first or third or fifth grade classroom and then doing that 1,000 times.
So watching kids grow up until age 17 in over 25 states, 1,000 children. Tell us, Bob Pianta with the Curry School of Education, what are some of the things that we learned about what's going on in American schools?
Well, we looked at two broad areas of classroom experiences for kids. We literally counted the minutes that they were involved in different kinds of activities. And then we spent time rating the quality of their involvement and the quality of teachers' interactions with them. When we just go in and count minutes, I think what we find is a somewhat surprising set of findings. So, for example, one of the things we often think about, we talk about this a lot of time in schools of education, is that teachers should teach in small groups, that's a more effective way to teach. We found that for the average child on the average day, about 3% of the occasions on which they have learning activities offered to them are in small groups. Very, very small amount of
3%.
3%. Very small time that's involved with small group instruction. Another thing that we find is that, again, this is not surprising, but the vast majority of what children are exposed to in terms of instruction involves literacy. And this is actually true. We'd certainly understand this to be true in first grade, but it's also true all the way up to fifth grade. We see math instruction being not at all present much in the curriculum in first grade. It grows to about half of what literacy is by the time kids are in fifth grade. Science, not a lot of time spent on science. So one of the things that's really, I think, somewhat surprising is and it actually is reflected in an awful lot of new initiatives coming out of state and federal government is to get more of a focus on math and science in the younger grades and figure out how to get it in there in the time that's available. The other thing that that we found when we look at the actual kinds and focus of the learning experience that kids have, regardless of the content area, we find that by ratios of exceeding 10 to 1. The kind of instruction that children get is very focused on, again, not surprising in our world today, getting an answer right or wrong or correct or incorrect. Not much exposure at all to activities that are what we would consider to be more open-ended, collaborative, problem-solving activities where kids are, in a sense, their understanding is stretched a little deeper and
critical
broader,
thinking.
Critical thinking,
yeah.
All those kinds of things. We just don't see that at all reflected in the learning opportunities in elementary school.
My wife would very quickly say, my wife who teaches at Washington Lee University, was in school for most of her life up until this time, she would say that she would totally agree with you and say, of course, well, we're just teaching kids to show up on time, sit down, do rote tasks, go home when they're told, to follow instructions, to groom people to work 9 to 5, to get them into the workforce, whether you get on a job and they teach you what they want you to know. And this is the education we would expect in this type of culture. Is that, you think there's truth to that?
Well, there's certainly a perspective on these results that's consistent with that. I think the other thing, though, that's quite interesting is that what we hear from the business community, when you do surveys of the business community, the kinds of skills they're really looking for, not inconsistent with what you just described, are those kind of problem solving skills, be able to work in a group, be able to think on your feet, be able to be given a problem that's not easy to solve and figure out a way to work it out in a team that gets you traction toward a solution.
Kind of thing that's missing
right
now.
That we're not seeing much of it right now. Right, exactly.
Bob Pianta is with the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. The phone lines are open at 977-1070 if you've got a comment or a question about your own child's experience in area schools. Pick up the phone, give us a call, 977-1070. This study was published in a recent edition of Science. It tracked more than 1,000 students in over 25 states from birth to age 17. Countless hours sitting in classrooms, watching children, watching teachers. Bob, you told the Daily Progress, quote, "I think we have plenty of evidence to suggest that just getting a degree or getting more experience or passing a test are very poor proxies for what you'll actually end up doing when you're in charge of a classroom. And this is particularly true in the elementary grades. What then should we do to properly teach these folks who really have a calling to teach our children?"
Yeah, and this is where I think our study can go a long way toward helping build, in a sense, the next generation of tools that we can use to support and train teachers. So, for example, if you look right now at the kinds of ways in which we train and certify teachers, we're often doing that simply on the basis of whether they've passed a certain number of courses or gone through a particular degree program, which in many cases produces terrific teachers. But when you're looking at thousands and thousands of teachers in thousands of classrooms from literally thousands of teacher education programs, that may not be the best way to do it. And in our data set, what we were able to look at was exactly that question. Does having a degree in a certain area, does having more experience or less experience, does being paid more or not being paid more, do all those things that we use at the policy level to try to shape or penetrate into classrooms to improve quality of teaching, do those matter? And we found that they, by and large, didn't. I think what
that's incredibly alarming. Yeah. Then, you know.
Well, you know, again, it's not necessarily surprising. You know, I think every one of us have had teachers that are new teachers that are terrifically skilled, and we've had experienced teachers that are not terrifically skilled. And what we're trying to do is call attention to the fact that that the important thing, perhaps, for us to be looking at is. Are the kinds of interactions that teachers are having with kids in classroom, and how do we best support teachers to do those things effectively? And when we present our data to teachers with that in mind, they're right on board. They're very readily able to look at the kinds of things that we observe and say, yes, these are the important things to be watching me do. Now, please help me try to figure out how to do it more effectively.
Bob, let's imagine you're governor of Virginia. What do you do? Or president? What do you do? Fix our schools. What should we do, like the top 1, 2, 3? What can we do as a community? And we'll talk about what parents can do in a minute. But what can we do as a community, as a state, as a nation, to improve these schools? Because I think everyone would admit, and your study certainly shows, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. I think the first thing we need to recognize is that the schools are doing a terrific job with a lot of kids. And that we may need to, you know, in some sense, recast this debate about whether the schools are doing a good job or a bad job and be more refined in the way that we look at it. We're not serving a lot of kids well who particularly need the schools to serve them well. So our real challenge is to try to figure that one out and to try to help teachers be more effective with those kind of kids with those kind of needs. We're also probably not serving a group of kids who are very well achieving otherwise at the, in a sense, the higher end of the achievement spectrum very well either. But we do a really good job with a lot of kids. And so it's not just about, you know, schools failing. But I think if I had, you know, the power of sitting in the governor's chair.
You're king for a day.
Right. One of the things I very much would institute a set of procedures whereby teachers could count on there being a regular visitor, if you will, to their classroom, whether that would be, you know, a virtual visitor or an actual visitor who was watching them teach, and was then be able that those experiences of being observed would then be connected to a set of supports for that teacher to be more effective. Then that person would be back in the classroom in a couple weeks down the road and see as the teacher's trying to implement those kind of suggestions and support, would be able to coach them and work with them around that. I would want to be finding the best teachers and essentially trying to describe in the as best a way as I can what it is they're doing, and then I'd want that knowledge to be exported, if you will, to the teachers who are struggling. And I think the only way we can do that is to move ourselves into classrooms and be visiting teachers on a regular basis. We do this in an awful lot of other professions. We don't really do it in teaching.
Why is that? Is it expensive? The unions don't want it? What's the deal?
I think it's probably a combination of things. I mean, first, I think people view it as expensive. But I think our study and other studies that are now being underway show that you can visit a lot of classrooms and do this sort of work in a relatively cost-effective manner. I think there's some kind of myth that teaching is just an art and that we haven't really been able to scientifically identify those elements of teachers' interactions with kids that really matter for kids. And I think we're past that now. Our study, aspects of teachers' behaviors with kids that we looked at are the kinds of features of teaching that we show in this study to be able to predict achievement gains. And on the union side of thing, I think one of the things that unions are going to face is, you know, right now the law is defining or may soon define an effective teacher as one who produces regularly gains on standardized achievement tests for kids. Now, do you want that to be the way that effective teaching gets defined, or would you rather have a way that's broader, more contextualized to an individual classroom, and encompasses all those things that teachers do to form relationships with kids, to support them through all sorts of other trials and tribulations that the average second grader might have, but that don't show up on standardized tests.
Bob Pianta is with the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. You mentioned the standards of learning, the testing. What are your feelings about that, about the SOLs here in Virginia or No Child Left Behind? I know those are two very different animals, but this idea of testing kids, I can tell you that I have a daughter who starts in an Albemarle County school this fall in the county in kindergarten, and I'm a little bummed because I went and looked at the curriculum, and other folks would be like, wow, this is great, but I wish there was more playtime. I wish there was more recess. I wish there was built in more time for imaginative play. There's like 30 minutes of recess all day long. Otherwise, it's reading, writing, math, science. So kindergarten is now what I think third or fourth grade used to be. It's amazing, all getting them ready for this SOL in third grade.
Yeah, so I think what you're describing is really the effects of what when I talk about it, I describe as kind of the first beat in educational reform and standards-based educational reform. So that's largely what we've done in the standards of learning in Virginia and what No Child Left Behind reflects, which is an attempt to define what children ought to know as a result of, you know, being exposed to our public education system, and then to develop metrics for assessing their progress on what they know, and then getting us to do a better job of providing the inputs to those classrooms that produce those outputs. Now, what we have now is really the first step. We've defined standards. We have standards in Virginia. Kids take a lot of tests. Is the sort of thing
doing it today, as a matter of fact.
They're doing it today, and they're preparing for it. And it's, you know, many people describe the results of our study as really being the results of a lot of test taking or focus on test taking. But I think what we need to be thinking about is not so much should we be trashing a notion of accountability that's framed around standards-based reform. I think everyone agrees that it's probably a good thing that schools are accountable in some ways for the public investment that's being made. The question is, how do we build upon this to move it ahead? So what would be the next step in educational reform? Might it be looking at these tests and saying if they're really measuring what we want them to measure? Should they be broader? Should they be deeper? Be a really good question to ask. Second beat might be let's focus on the inputs. And so rather than just focusing on teacher qualifications, let's say, or teachers passing tests, should we maybe be paying attention to what teachers are doing with kids in classrooms and providing them with meaningful supports and effective supports around what they're doing?
So more metrics for the actual teaching process,
exactly,
rather than the
right
grades on the test.
Right, exactly. Because, you know, in a sense, what No Child Left Behind has proven, which is an extraordinary thing, 10 or 15 years ago, people were saying the public schools couldn't change. There was nothing you could do to schools that would change them. Once these, you know, schools are very different places now in the way you just described than they were 10 years ago. So, in some sense, we've proven that if you put in an accountability framework and you measure something, then the school system will change to reflect that measure. So our big challenge right now is to say, is this the only thing we want? Okay, or should we be thinking about what the next set of accountability metrics are? Because our experience tells us that once we put those in place, the system is going to migrate in that direction.
So they will respond, and it will improve.
Absolutely respond.
Yeah. We got about 1 minute left. Really quickly, given the results of your study here, Bob Pianta with the Curry School of Education, what is your recommendation to parents like me with 2 5-year-olds getting ready to go into the school system? What do we need to be doing, whether it's after school or in the evenings or on the weekends? What can we do perhaps to compensate for what they may not be getting in school, or what they might be getting too much of in school?
Right. Well, first off, they're going to get a lot in school. And most of what I when I talk to parents about these things, I basically try to reduce their anxiety about what kids are going to be getting in school. Your kids, you know, one of the big findings from our study was that across the board, these classrooms were places that were socially and emotionally positive and supportive for kids.
That's really encouraging.
It's very encouraging. And so most kids enjoy their experiences at school, and most parents feel very pleased with their kids' experiences with school. What I tell parents is, you know, largely your kids are going to learn a lot by being in school, so relax, watch them learn, get to know your kid's teacher, and spend the kind of time with your kid after school that your kid likes to spend with you.
Bob Pianta is with the Curry School of Education. New study recently published in Science tracked more than 1,000 students in more than 25 states from birth to age 17, the biggest study of its kind in the history of the country. Bob, thank you very, very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Coy. Thanks.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit sevillepodcast.com for more.